Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Metz.
Hello, and thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll put some context around the numbers, perspective around the politics, clarity around the choices facing us in South Africa. A warm welcome. I'm Jeremy Maggs. Coming up on the program today, South Africa keeps asking more of its soldiers but gives them less to work with. Is the SANDF now facing an impossible mission? Author and journalist Max Dupria joins us on white fear, grievance, politics, and the end of what he calls the old normal. South Africa's renewable energy reforms face a hard question. Are we building more power or simply creating a longer queue for a constrained grid? And Father's Day gets a rethink. Why more dads are swapping socks and mugs for play, nostalgia, collectibles, and shared experiences. It's Friday, the 19th of June. Now, the South African National Defence Force is expected to guard borders, protect maritime interests, support the police, respond to domestic crises, and still maintain a credible defence capability. Yet, as you are well aware, its budget is shrinking in real terms. Personnel costs are crowding out operations, and some of its most important equipment exists more convincingly on paper than in the field. So is the country quietly creating a hollow force while still pretending it has full military capability? I'm in conversation now with Kobus Maree, who's an independent defence commentator and analyst. Kobus, a very warm welcome to you. And in your opinion, then, is the SANDF now being asked to perform a constitutional mandate that it can simply no longer afford?
I think it has transpired over many years. We have seen a deterioration in the capabilities of the Defence Force and a decline in the real increase of the Defence Force's budget. For quite some time, there was a defence policy set out exactly what the objectives are and what the funding targets are. Now, over time, when this real increase has decreased significantly over many years, South Africa's defense budget should be very close to 1.5% of GDP or the international global benchmark of 2% of GDP. Currently, we are at less than 0.7% of GDP. Now, it is obviously it's not sustainable. One must remember that cost of employees are currently well over 70% of the approved budget of the Defence Force. And that is a kind of a fixed cost. Because, the employees of the Defence Force has been appointed for a long term. So it's not just call up or, as we were in our younger days, just conscripts. Mm. So there's a fixed commitment of that. And if the budget in real terms decreases, it means that percentage is obviously increasing. And it means that the actual constitutional mandate of protecting our countries, the sovereignty of our country, securing the safety of our people is just not possible anymore. And as the appetite for constant ad hoc deployment has increased, the moment that there's a problem with any State Department, whether it is water affairs, whether it is the police, whether it is, border safeguarding, then they call on the Defence Force to be deployed. And all of that is extra costs that is just not sustainable. So, yes. The constitutional mandate is the same. The appetite for deployment has increased, while the resources and the funding has significantly decreased.
Kobus,
it's just not sustainable.
Let me pick you up on that 70% of the budget going to personnel. Maybe put that into some kind of context for us and explain to me, does the SANDF have too many people or are the pay scales out of kilter?
I think neither of the two is really true. There's not necessarily too many people. Yes, you can reduce the Defence Force's employment numbers. The scaling is not, I don't think it's a problem because you need a professional Defence Force. But one must remember, if we had a defence budget of 1% of GDP, that would give us another 30 billion rand for Defence Force. That means that the current cost of employee spending would suddenly drop from over 70% of the approved budget to below 50% of the budget. So, yes, there must be restructuring. Yes, the Defence Force staff is too old on an average. Yes, they are too expensive. Yes, there are too many people in senior ranks, and not the rejuvenation program is not successful, and it's also not sustainable, because we are, you know, you can't go to war with an aging Defence Force. But it needs restructuring, it needs reprioritization, and obviously focused on technology rather than just employment. So it's a combination of these things. It's not necessarily either the one or the other.
You talk about you can't go to war with an aging defense force, Kobus. Are you also suggesting that our border protection has weakened considerably by the military just being stretched too thin when it comes to manpower and resourcing?
Absolutely, there's no doubt. Years ago, there was about over 30 defense companies being deployed on the land borders of South Africa. We currently need not less than 25 to 27 companies. Currently, there's only 5 companies. Now, that means only the patrolling of the defense force. Now, physically boots on the ground patrolling is just not adequate and enough anymore. If you can't support that with technology, with radars, modern technology radars, sensors, so that you can deploy soldiers where there are transgressions. So often there are crossings taking place and transgressions taking place on our borders that we just don't know about, because we haven't got the technology and a full reconnaissance capability to know what is really going on. And I've seen it myself on test screens of radars with one of our well-known private sector technology companies, where you can clearly see once the soldier has passed a specific point, then suddenly that whole queue of people is moving across the border unhindered, no problem, and the Defence Force doesn't even know about that.
So, Kobus, just a final question then. If it's all about funding, if you give the SANDF more money, is there a risk that you're rewarding the same failures unless there is serious reform, as you've suggested?
Let me be clear. More money is not the solution. Just more money, plain more money,
right,
is not the solution. Cutting employee costs itself is not a solution. If it's not accompanied by serious reform, serious reprioritization, and facing the current future, the current threats and future threats, then it is a waste of money. So just by giving more money, just by giving 1 or 1.5% of GDP will not solve the problem. We've got management problems and challenges. We've got executive oversight problems and challenges. We've got technology problems and challenges. Mm. We've got prime mission equipment is old. So without prime mission equipment, without a proper defense industry base supporting the defense force, without a Denel and an Arms Corps restructuring and refocus, it will not help. So all of these needs to happen in relation to each other. Otherwise, it is a waste of money. But yes, we need more money. If there's not more money, you can reprioritize and restructure as much as you want, and you will not achieve it because you don't have the resources.
I'm going to leave it there. Thank you very much indeed for the analysis. It is a very worrying situation. Kobus Maree, independent defense analyst, I appreciate your time.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Max du Preez has spent a lifetime arguing with the tribe that he came from. In his new book, it's called The End of Normal, A Witness to the Unraveling of White Power in South Africa, the veteran journalist and author returns to 1976, to Soweto, to Afrikaner nationalism, and to the slow collapse of the world that shaped him. But I think this is not just a book about apartheid history. It's also about today. It's about white fear, Afrikaner identity, the politics of grievance, and whether Afrikaans South Africans can find a confident, generous, and useful place in the country's future. Max Dupriya joins us on the program now. Max, welcome to you. And you write as someone who came from inside Afrikanerdom and then became one of its fiercest critics. Maybe bringing it to the here and now, what do you think white Afrikaners still struggle to understand about the country they lost and now won that they've also helped rebuild?
Yeah, Jeremy, I must say I'm a harsh critic of my tribe, but I also have a lot of empathy for a people, and I tell in broad strokes the stories from through my own family from Jan van Riebeeck's days and the Freeburgers and the Great Trek and the Boer Republics. I have a bit of empathy for a people who struggled, and I forced myself not to judge them according to today's sensibilities, because I think that's a mistake we often make. We look at the Boer Republics or the early 1900s Afrikaner, and we expect them to be progressive liberals. For them to struggle so hard to form a republic and to govern and get access into the economy and become economically successful, and then suddenly to lose most of that psychologically, it's traumatic. In world history, one would say this is traumatic. And I think Nelson Mandela smoothed that process over in the beginning, but he also did us a disservice, because Afrikaners loved him. They called him Madiba. I mean, like a year before, they called him the bloody terrorist. They called him Madiba, and they loved him, and he went to see Betsy Verwoerd, and he put on the number 6 jersey at the World Cup, and it wasn't real. And only when Thabo Mbeki became president and said, the time for sucking up and appeasement is over, can we start fixing this country and fixing injustice, that the alienation started. So for quite a while, for a good 10 years, Afrikaners saw no change in their lives. The only thing was the guy in the convoy of black limousines had a black face. But for the rest, it was the same. And then slowly South Africa started becoming what it is today, with black people getting into the economy. Suddenly you find yourself that your manager is a black guy or your neighbor is black. And I don't think there was anybody out there in the leadership who helped them to do it. Help them to accept this new reality. Instead, in the last 2.5 decades, we had AfriForum and Solidarity, who zoomed in on this grievance and made it worse and peddled in fear and intolerance and told them that they were victims. And, we all know that story.
Right.
And I think it's quite sad. I told a story about, I had a long interview with the head of the Broederbond, Pieter de Lange, who told me quite passionately about how the Afrikaner Broederbond, the secret Afrikaner society of men, helped the Afrikaners live a good life in the cities after the Anglo-Boer War when they were impoverished. And I keep on thinking, why couldn't AfriForum and Solidarity do that? Say, our job is to help Afrikaners accept a non-racial democracy, a new system.
Max, picking up on one point that you make, these days, in 2026, we hear more claims of Afrikaner victimhood, persecution, and I guess even cultural siege. As you look again at your tribe, how much of that is real and how much do you think is expediency and manufactured politics?
No, I think it's mostly manufactured politics, and a good bit is phantom pain. It's a phantom pain. Your limb had been amputated 30 years ago, and typically you still feel the pain in that arm that isn't there anymore. It's a phantom pain, and it's been exacerbated by the new breed of Afrikaner nationalists who came from the right wing. I think this is very important to understand, that Flip Bass and Kali Creel all came from the far right in South Africa, and they didn't change their views. They just got rid of the camouflage and the khaki, and they now have degrees, and they would never say the K word. But the message is the same, is that we are not a part of South Africa. That is the fundamental message. We are not a part of South Africa. That's why I'm saying it's the AfriForum Solidarity, the only people, and nowadays also the Freedom Front Plus, the only party who reject our constitution in its entirety. MK wants to scrap this, and EFF wants to, you know, do away with the property clause. But AfriForum and Solidarity say there is no one South Africa. It's not we the people, it's we the peoples.
So,
and I think that is dangerous.
So who then, leading on from that, speaks for Afrikaners right now? Are there credible new leaders who are maybe not trapped in that nostalgia or grievance or racial defensiveness that you reference?
No, unfortunately, there aren't any. And there's a reason for that. Most Afrikaners vote for the Democratic Alliance. Even most of the supporters of Solidarity and AfriForum vote for the DA. The statistics show that. The DA has to be a broad church for other English, for other white South Africans, but other minority groups, and increasingly to find support among black people. So they cannot speak for Afrikaners. AfriForum and Solidarity are the biggest bodies representing organized Afrikaners. And then there are people, you know, like me. We have a little organization called Afrikaners for South Africa. When we signed a petition to Trump, when he declared there's a genocide and he started importing so-called refugees to America. But we're a small voice. So the Afrikanerdom is very multifaceted. There is no typical Afrikaner. But it was organized in a very efficient and a very attractive way, in the sense that AfriForum and Solidarity are very impressive in building stuff. They build the university, they build a technicon, they take the government to court, they do all kinds of things, and they do it swiftly, without corruption, without stealing. And the contrast to what the state is doing is so big that it becomes attractive.
And a final question, you do remain optimistic, though. You conclude the book with a chapter, Making Afrikaners Great Again. Max de Pree, if you have to speak then directly to a young Afrikaans person who might very well feel alienated from this country, what are you going to tell them?
I would say, take a trip to the world, go outside our borders and come back and see, experience the tolerance, the open society. We're the most open society in the global south. Feel the magic, feel the acceptance by the majority of Afrikaners. I'm not a detribalized Afrikaner. I'm a proper one. And I have never felt not at home in my society. I feel overwhelmingly accepted, despite some social media nonsense. And I think it's the land of opportunity for a young Afrikaner. We've been here for more than 300 years. We've become Africans. We're not settlers. We have become Africans. Live up to that and embrace it. It's still the land of opportunity, and it's a very exciting society.
The book is called The End of Normal, Witness to the Unraveling of White Power in South Africa. The publisher is Jonathan Ball, and the author is Max de Pree. Max, thank you very much.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
South Africa's renewable energy program has long been seen as one of the country's great public-private success stories. It's brought investment, credibility, and badly needed new generation into the system. But the electricity market is changing. Private buyers are now active, wind and solar are commercially mature, and the real constraint is no longer just generation, but grid access, flexibility, and system stability. So the question is government still procuring the right kind of power, or is it maybe using yesterday's or an old model for tomorrow's electricity market? Someone who's applied her mind to that is Olga Sachkova, who's an associate director at the advisory firm Cresco. Olga, a very warm welcome to South Africa's Renewable Energy Independent Power Producer Procurement Program. Has it, in your opinion, gone from solving the country's energy problem to possibly becoming part of the bottleneck?
Yes, I think to a large extent, the solution that was developed by the IPP office and REAP design is slightly outdated. There are new challenges. The sector has moved on. New initiatives are unfolding as we speak. So in my opinion, yes, REAP needs to evolve as well. And I wouldn't say that it creates new bottlenecks, but it certainly doesn't solve the issues that we would like the government to be solving.
And the fundamental problem then is transmission more than generation. Would I be correct?
Yes, at this point in time, you would be correct, yes.
So how do we get around that? How do you need to recalibrate or readapt the model to make sure that it's meeting those modern and changing needs?
Well, you definitely need to have signals, right? So the way the design of the program needs to change is to create those signals. You know, you need to take grid constraints into consideration. You need to provide a solution for the projects to be located in the right grid zone. So that's just the basic requirement. But also, I think the whole focus needs to shift, right? We're not interested in just pure renewable energy technologies. These are there's sufficient demand in the private sector. Those type of technologies, they can be implemented with other government interventions. So the government really needs to reassess where their support is required. And so from that perspective, it doesn't only go into the grid, but also into the technologies and what issues we're trying to solve.
So if you're saying that private buyers can now fund wind and solar and government is still underwriting them, that's perhaps something of the past. It needs to refocus where it's going to put its support. And you reference new technologies in that respect. Where should the principal focus be then, in your opinion?
Flexibility. I think we mentioned that in our article, and I'm happy to reemphasize that, right? So flexibility is one of the key issues that we see. And obviously, there are a number of ways that can address flexibility. The government has been procuring BESS, so we are very happy to see those bid windows, you know, procure with BESS procurement. Gas IPP just closed last week or the week before. So that is another this is one of the right solutions. At the same time, the question is how feasible those projects are, but that's a separate discussion, I guess. So from that perspective, flexibility is definitely the right focus. But I think what we started off with, grid and access to the grid and grid development is a concern. ITP, the Independent Transmission Program, unfortunately is not really developing as quickly as we would like it to. So that clearly should be the focus area within the government.
I'm interested in your observation about flexibility. Is the problem there poor policy, or is it simply inertia and an inability to perhaps gather momentum quickly?
It's a very complex problem, I'll be honest with you. Unfortunately, from the flexibility perspective, South Africa is abundant in coal. South Africa is abundant in renewables. Gas, there are some gas discoveries, you know, in South Africa. Unfortunately, the state of the development of those fields is not, it's in the early development. So there are, a lot of work that needs to be put into those projects. And then the question is, you know, where do we get the fuel? If we talk about, you know, gas projects, well, where will gas come from? And then you have projects that depend on each other, and that creates just a separate type of problem. So I think it's a little bit of everything. Definitely, you know, regulatory aspects could be revised and improved to sort of assist with the implementation. But it's also just the whole, you know, development phase. As you say, inertia. I think we could have a better focus on these issues and try more proactively come up with a solution.
So what would the biggest reform mistake be that South Africa should avoid?
Yeah, that's a good question. As you were very well aware, you know, there are numerous reforms taking place. And there are so many things that potentially could go wrong, you know. And last thing we want is sort of a delay in any of these reforms, because it will have a ripple effect. So from that perspective, we need to renew our energy mix. And so from that perspective, we need to security of supply, electricity supply is one of the critical issues that South Africa is facing today. And we definitely need to structure our, you know, way forward to make sure we address that issue. Because the economic growth of South Africa depends directly on the security of supply. Cost of electricity is another issue. So all of this ultimately will impact the economic growth and then the sustainability of
Do you think we need to rethink the way then in which auctions are handled?
Yes, that as well, definitely. We need to make sure that, you know, all the different reforms, I think there needs to be an alignment in all those different initiatives that are taking place. And I think this is one of the key messages we were trying to put across with our article. Exactly that. You know, you have all those different initiatives, and we just need to make sure they all, you know, they're aligned in the ultimate goal that we're trying to achieve. And yes, from the auction perspective, definitely it needs to be revised to make sure that we are heading towards liberalization, lower cost of supply, secured, the supply is secured, new capacities coming online, and the projects are bankable at the end of the day.
Olga Sochkova is Associate Director at the advisory firm Cresco. Thank you very much for talking to me.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, Father's Day used to be easy to mock. Socks, ties, mugs, and a last-minute card. But something more interesting seems to be happening. More families are moving away from purely practical gifts and towards shared experiences, nostalgia, collectibles, fandoms, and play. It's not just about toys. It's not just about retail. I think it says something about modern fatherhood, how adults are trying to reconnect with childhood passions, and how parents and children find new ways to bond in a busy, screen-heavy world. I'm going to talk now to Catherine Jacoby, who's Marketing Director at Toys R Us. Catherine, just ahead of Father's Day, do you think gifts are changing because dads have changed or because families are changing?
Yes, absolutely. I do think the traditional gifting world has changed. We're seeing the modern dad, born in the 80s, 90s, or even early 2000s, looking for experience rather than things to collect. You know, we've seen how parents have evolved, and especially dads these days are more involved in parenthood compared to back in the day. And they want to spend more time with their children and share what they grew up with, whatever that passion is or that nostalgic moment that they return to from childhood. They want to pass that on to the next generation. So certainly gifting has become more about the experience, like you mentioned, and less about something that is less memorable.
So it's adults, and I count myself in that cohort, trying to recover something that they lost. Yeah?
Yes. It's, you know, everybody's childhood mostly was something they were fond of, and where there was memories of joy and fun and laughter and a sense of escapism, really. And that nostalgic feeling of going back to what brought you that joy is something that a lot of adults these days want to relive. You also mentioned the busy lives that we all have, immersed in work and duties and responsibilities. And just going back to that moment of pure happiness is something that we all long for.
Which tells us that the traditional presents, and again, I have received many in my lifetime, like socks and mugs, they've become emotionally thin, right?
Yes, they have. And they, like I said, are not memorable. You know, in years from now, your children are not going to remember the socks that they gave you or what it said on the pajamas, but they will remember that the time that they spent with you and the moments of play where you got to imagine a fort in the lounge or building a Lego set together or collecting Hot Wheels cars. So that's what they're going to remember, not a traditional gift, as we know, like the socks and the mugs.
So let's talk a little bit about those moments of play, as you refer to it, as dads are more inclined these days to appreciate things like collectibles and games. What type of things then are moving?
We're seeing Lego having a massive boom at the moment globally. And I don't think there's any grown man or dad in the world that doesn't like a good Lego build. And that's something that you can do with your child. There seems to also be a surge in collectible toys, being Hot Wheels cars, Funko Pops, a lot of items that are around movie releases. So going back to Masters of the Universe and Spider-Man. And these become prized possessions that dads collect and, you know, really take pride in going back to what brings them joy.
I've got to wonder whether it's the families buying the stuff for the dads or the dads sneaking into the shop and buying it for themselves. Again, Catherine, I do plead guilty.
Yes, we do often see a dad wandering around in the store and sneaking off to find something that they like. But that's part of the fun. And we often underestimate that play is not only important for children, but it is important for adults too. You know, it's a stress reliever. It brings you to a world where you can imagine things. It's a sense of escapism. And it also has benefits, connecting with your family, building those relationships, and really just having moments together.
Do you think, though, that brands sometimes might be a little too quick to commercialize the nostalgia, Catherine, that we're talking about? Or is that simply where culture has moved?
I think it's more that the brands have capitalized on the trend and the shift in consumer behavior and consumer sentiment. There definitely is a new generation, like I've said, those 80s, 90s, early 2000s babies are really showing up as fathers and as parents differently to what we saw in traditional spaces. There's a shared responsibility for income. Often families have a dual parents working, and dads are more involved by nature as a result of moms obviously having to work as well. So dads are now part of raising their children more actively. And I think the brands are just following that trend and playing into it quite nicely.
And probably the most inappropriate question to ask you at a time of giving, but collectibles that you've referenced, I'm assuming that they would over time realize some kind of long-term value.
Yes, there are definitely some very valuable valuable toys out there. And we do see the brands leaning into limited editions and exclusives and producing limited quantities of certain items. So they have become very valuable collectibles. We were at Comic-Con last year and people were going mad to collect the various exclusive or limited edition items. And they can really become quite something, your modern investment.
Do you think that the shared play, Catherine, that you spoke about matters more now? Because as I referenced in the introduction, so much of family life these days is fragmented by screens.
It definitely is. And it's quite hard to ignore. It's not something that we want to ignore because it's only going to evolve. It's a very integral part of our lives these days and can play quite a valuable role from learning devices, communication, all sorts of benefits of the digital world. But it's about making space for play and not discrediting the importance that play can bring to one's life and to one's family relationships, because it is an important and integral part of a child's development. And like I say, it's equally important for adults to play too. And there's numerous developmental benefits, as well as that shared bond, which screens obviously can't do.
So more collectibles, less socks and mugs. Catherine Jacoby, mm-hmm. Thank you very much indeed. Marketing Director at Toys R Us. I appreciate your time. And that is our program for today and for the week. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday, and we're here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.